Economic Development, and I am going to reopen the public hearing on House Bills 2732 and 2842. We're now in public hearing. Ellen, if you would please read a brief summary of the bills.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 2732 redefines disabled individual for the purposes of the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. It redefines it as an individual who, because of the nature of the disabilities, is not able to participate fully in competitive employment with reasonable accommodation and for whom specialized employment opportunities must be provided. House Bill 2842 creates the Commission for the Products of Disabled Individuals as an oversight committee, and the purpose is to establish the policies that are used to evaluate qualified rehabilitation facilities who provide products and services to public agencies. It also is established to handle appeals from these QRFs who have been denied certification.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to call up first Deb Houston and Robert Deenan, please. Hello. Good evening. Committee.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Robert Deenan, and I'm an owner of a business that is for remanufacturing toner cartridges. And I'm directly affected by the rehab facilities that are currently trying to do that work. And it's not that I'm against the severely handicapped doing or having work. As a matter of fact, my background is that I have a master's degree in education and have taught severely handicapped for 9 years in public schools. So it's not that I'm against it at all. On the contrary, I want the definition to actually include severely handicapped. And one of the biggest reasons why I feel that it needs to be in there is because that the rehab facility that is doing the cartridges, apparently, well, 2 years ago, were having some difficulty with the task. So they got a good idea to go to a corrections facility in Eastern Oregon and actually build a workshop for inmates to do the work instead of the severely handicapped. And so the reason, quite frankly, is that the product that they were working on, in my opinion, appeared to be more important than the individuals that they had hired to do it. So they moved the work, and supposedly to help the severely handicapped. And that is, in my view, not what the law was meant to establish, is activity centers on, corrections facilities. And so I'd like to thank you, and it's going to be brief, thank you for an opportunity to share that with you. I submitted written testimony last week, so if you have any questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Deenan from the committee? Could you tell me, sir, you mentioned that they, I think your words were they moved the work.
Well, the work was at one time being done at a facility somewhere outside of Baker and Baker City. And so the documentation that I read is that they were having difficulty with the process, and someone came up with the idea that they could use inmates.
And so they could use, I'm sorry?
Inmates.
Oh, okay.
And so when I found out about the fact that they were going to build a facility for that on corrections property, I tried to submit a protest for that, And as it turned out, I found out pretty late in the game, but I got it in time. But the fact is they started the project 2 months before the end that I had a chance to complain about it. So even though we have a chance to give some kind of protest to it, it was really a moot point since it's already the building of the project had already begun. It was almost completed, if not completed.
And can you help me to better understand? My understanding is that the PDIL was established ostensibly for severely disabled workers. Now, you're talking about ex-inmates?
No, these people are inmates.
Inmates. At the time, current inmates.
Yes.
And were they... Were they approved under the PDIL? Can you enlighten me or explain to me how that worked? Were they disabled inmates?
That's the claim.
I see. Okay. All right. Further questions? I'm not seeing any. Maybe just one additional question. Did you happen to witness the workforce?
I did not go to the Powder River facility, no.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, that that concludes our list from the last hearing. So we're going to begin with the folks that have newly signed up this evening. And let's see here. We have Tom Chamberlain, Mary Botkin, and Robert just testified. And that'll be our first panel. Good evening.
Good evening.
Myself. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and the Oregon AFL-CIO supports HB 2732 and HB 2842. It deals with the continuing problem with qualified rehabilitation facilities, displacement of public and private workers through no-bid contracts with public agencies. As I understand it, the PDIL, adopted in 1977, was designed to provide additional government assistance to a unique population of disabled individuals that were unable to fully participate in competitive employment with reasonable accommodations under the ADA. The AFL supports the intent of PDIL, but as the law is carried out now, family wage jobs are often lost to individuals recruited by QRFs who are paid lower wages with less benefits and who are able to compete in the workplace. The definition of disabled has been broadened through the years to include individuals with drug and alcohol problems and numerous health problems, which may qualify as a disability, but as a whole should not preclude these individuals from competing with other qualified individuals in the workplace, and certainly should not merit the displacement of hard-working Oregonians, many which are disabled themselves. We support HB 2732 to better define the population of disabled to be sure to be served by the PDIL. We're also concerned with a lack of oversight for the multi-million dollar taxpayer-supported program and support a public commission appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to oversee the PDIL. The commission should have balanced representation from labor and business as well as advocate from the disabled community. Additionally, we support making the commission subject to the public meetings law. Labor is committed to the assimilation of individuals with disabilities into the workforce and welcomes the amendments to HB 2842-2732 to charge the new public commission with developing policies to assist in those efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here this evening representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we're here in support of House Bill 2842 and House Bill 2732. We are in a very unique position in that our union represents pretty much people on all sides of this issue. We represent QRFs and folks who work there. We represent clients who work for the QRFs. We represent folks who have been displaced by these no-bid contracts. So this is a challenging issue for us. For more than 20 years, our union has worked actively to gain economic parity for the workforce with public sector workers. We have fought the QRF industry, a shrinking state budget, and in general, the belief that these jobs can be contracted out to the lowest bidder in hopes that the money saved would go into increased programs and opportunities for the clients that live in the facilities that we represent. It seems to us that the only people who have made any gains in the industry are the individuals who own and manage the businesses. In fact, we just won an election where the manager of one of our QRFs tried to convince the workers that they no longer needed a union. The company spent thousands of dollars trying to keep their employees from having a voice in the workplace and from bargaining for better wages and benefits. We won this election 2-1. Unfortunately, the losers were the clients who will have fewer dollars for programs, fewer opportunities to get wages, and the workers who will not get a wage increase this year. And the winner in this case is a downtown Portland law firm who charged thousands of dollars and were paid by the hour for a failed campaign. We're here because we agree with Ms. Guest that the system is out of control. We have seen more and more contracts released for this, for a severely disabled workforce who never seem to get the jobs. It has gotten so far out of control that even the Department of Corrections has now found a way to qualify as a QRF. I've attached an article to my testimony about the program they now run inside the secure perimeter of the Baker City facility in Eastern Oregon. This program had employed 75 Oregon citizens who were not doing time, rebuilding transcoder ink cartridges. Now, because the Prison Industries Program, Oregon Corrections Enterprises, was able to qualify inmates as disabled under the current definitions, which have been expanded over the years to include recovering drug and alcohol abusers, ODOC has now taken over the contract from the state, with the state of Oregon, putting inmates to work helping to meet the requirements of ballot measure 17. Under the current definition of the 12, today I checked to see what our inmate population was today, and the inmate population today is 12,888. Under our under these definitions, approximately 85% of that population would qualify as disabled. And so that means that we have a workforce, a potential workforce of 10,954 inmates available and qualified as disabled to go to work under a QRF. We find this disturbing at best. There's a lot of misinformation about this bill, and in our opinion, the bill is designed to protect and expand employment opportunities for the clients of the programs provided in facilities such as the Star of Hope in Coos Bay, Coast Rehab in Astoria, and others around Oregon. We're strong advocates of these programs because we know there's little more important to our clients than their jobs. However, we also believe there's a difference between the citizens of Oregon with disabilities who have few choices because of circumstances beyond their control, and those individuals who have made bad choices and now find themselves qualified as disabled because they are in recovery. While others have expanded definitions beyond the original intent of the public contracting laws, thereby qualifying these persons for protected and subsidized employment opportunities, we are disturbed because our clients with disabilities are forced to compete with the individuals who do not face the same challenges day to day over a day-to-day basis and over a lifetime. Our clients may never have the opportunity to fully compete, and they should get all the assistance the law, government, and private sector can provide. We urge you to return to the original intent of these laws and the opportunities provided to people with disabilities. Expand the job market for our clients, and don't let those who profit from this business to continue to profit from the work and the hardships of our clients and our members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel? Representative Dolan?
Yes, Mary.
Good evening, sir.
I shouldn't be so informal, but we do know one another. You've talked about the QRF, and I'm going to call one group workers, and those are the people that supervise the program and see to safety and production and that sort of thing. And then there's, I'm going to call the project participants. If I were to ask you, and do you represent the workers? Could you tell me what kind of an average wage is?
For our members?
Yeah.
Slightly above minimum wage, about it varies greatly, but they make about $9 an hour with no benefits and no health care.
And then the project participants, the people that are doing the work, do you represent them, or does your association represent them?
No.
No. Okay. Thanks, Mary. Oh, with displaced workers, do you have a number? You said you represent all across the spectrum, and some of your workers were displaced. Can you give me a notion of how many?
Probably about 300 or 400 have been displaced as a result of no-bid contracts. These are not huge numbers. There are not a lot of job opportunities for our clients. And so, we try to hang on to as many of those job opportunities as we can. In fact, we have used QRF services within our own union. For a while, we used a QRF here in Salem to do the janitorial services in our Salem office. We had an unfortunate incident that made that impossible to continue, but we have utilized their services. We put together new employee packets when we do new employee meetings in our work sites, and oftentimes we will use QRF's services. We'll contract with them to bring the clients in to do the compilation of the packets, because that is work that they can do. And we found that to be very beneficial both to the QRFs that we represent and to the clients and for us. And it saves our secretaries time from doing it.
Thank you very much.
Mary, you stated there's a very high percentage of the state's inmate population that would likely qualify or be certified as disabled. Can you tell us a little bit more how they are qualified?
Because under the current definitions, drug and alcohol abuse qualify you as a disabled worker. Mr. Chair, if I can, let me just say that we are firm believers that the only way to reduce recidivism is through very aggressive and active alcohol and drug treatment programs and employment opportunities at the end of that sentence. And our advocates for increased funding for those programs inside the institutions. However, we think that there's a difference between severely disabled individuals and folks who have made bad choices in their lives. And while we would support some aggressive jobs programs for recovering inmates, we don't think that they should be competing with the severely disabled population that are not in their situation because of bad choices, but rather through circumstances beyond their control.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
I'm searching for all the politically correct terms, knowing that the audience behind me is sensitive to that.
Well, could you suggest means by which that competition that you deemed inappropriate could perhaps be minimized?
Yeah, I don't think that we should qualify drug and alcohol abusers under a QRF program. I think that we should reserve the QRF programs and the enhanced benefits that we provide to the employer and to the workforce for that population that is disabled through no fault of their own.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much.
Appreciate
your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Don Carmichael, Shane Chandler, and Masood. I'm going to apologize because I'm not even going to get close to the last name here. Is there a Masood that begins with, I believe it's either an M or an N for the last name? Okay.
I've heard all sorts of pronouncements.
My apologies.
No problem.
Please, whatever works for the three of you in terms of the order that you choose to proceed.
No, that moment there. My name is Masood Malagathari, to make it easier for pronunciation. I am very new to the non-profit organizations. I've been trained and brought in for-profit organizations for the last 30 years, as recently for Intel. And in this age of my life, I decided to find happiness more than money, and I decided to go to a facility that provides benefits to people that I thought may need my help more than the ones I was working with before. I joined about 5 months ago for a company called Portland Rehabilitation Center, which seems to be sometimes in the center of some of the growth issues we may have. And I've been coming to these meetings, and I try to study the bills. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how to study the bills. But it seems to be shooting for a moving target. I can never figure out when the changes stop, so I can't really work on that process. But I just heard a few things and I'd like to discuss what I think from a for-profit organization that I came to a non-profit organization and my perspective. I studied nuclear engineering with my postgraduate work in computer science, and I've managed companies for for-profit, and I moved away, and it was not for a pay raise when I moved away. So there is not that much money involved to begin with. A couple of things besides this orientation. For a profit-minded person that goes to a non-profit organization, it feels like you have to press the reset button on your head every day and start thinking about people and instead of money. So when I find myself conflicted most of the time trying to put aside my original training that reduce labor and increase gross sales, and trying to put myself in that formula, and then the objective is reduce waste, increase labor, and forget about profit. It's a very difficult task to go through because it's a transition that not very many people have to make at my age. And so knowing that struggle, some of the numbers that we've heard in the last hearing were the growth over 30 years from $1 million of gross sales to $50 million of gross sales that was distributed from the state agencies to quote-unquote the combination of non-profit companies. And I'd like to inform you, being from a for-profit organization, that's equivalent of 20 Starbucks around the corner that employ 500 people. So $50 million for a for-profit company is not much, but where they employ 4,000 employees. If Intel was running numbers like that we would be shutting it down in 2 weeks. It's equivalent of $12,000 plus per year gross wages for that 4,000 people and $50 million. $12,000 a year is not a huge amount of investment that a country such as ours can make in occupying and employing people while training them to give them a chance, not necessarily the final goal, but a chance for a better life. When I hear about $50 million, I always ask my colleagues, where are the rest of the zeros? And because we're just not used to hearing numbers that little for that many employment. Generally, 20 Starbucks grows about $50 million in 1 year, and they employ 500 people. And if they sell every half an hour less than that, they shut down the Starbucks. That happened in Tiananmen Square in the Forbidden City. So when you put people like myself in my past in charge of commissions that are not necessarily have the well-being of initiation of the process for a person with disability in mind, because you're thinking about profits, they lose the efficiency that is required to think about people with disability in terms of their training. Think about that when you make your decision. It's two different sets of efficiencies in control of a human mind. One is directly related to efficiency for business improvements, and two is the efficiency for human welfare improvements. Two different study courses in the universities to human sciences versus business, or two different schools in every university, as you all very well. As far as the the question was asked, where does the money go in the $50 million? Thinking that it's a lot of money. It's really not. It's $12,000 per person. The money goes to wages, benefits. Some of the companies that I was contemplating before trying to think to join Peace Corps with my wife, and we decided to not do that yet and try to do something closer to home. And they pay union wages. So the conflict between the unions is non-existent, it's fabricated. They pay benefits, they pay health insurance, they pay dental insurance, and for some employees that takes probably about 3 to 4 hours to pair up two shoelaces so they're the same size, they still provide benefits. And for those employees that are super severely disabled, not just severely disabled, the fact that they get away from their normal environment that is a malaise in some situations, away from that, and they're brought to the facility that they can work with the long-term friends they've been working with and hanging around with, is a fantastic improvement in quality of life. You have to consider that when you make these decisions for people that in the human sciences, not necessarily business markets. Any company would not allow, if it's designed for a for-profit organization, for any employee to have 4% productivity. We have to. It is the mission that we need to fulfill. So when you combine commissions that have four members of the commission, two union members, and two for-profit organizations, you are creating a natural conflict in the decision-making process between the two separate disciplines that need to make the decisions. Be aware of that. If I was on that commission from a for-profit organization, I wouldn't be able to think in terms of human sciences. It would be very difficult to find people with both characteristics simultaneously. It's just very difficult. I haven't found one yet. I'm trying very hard to become one, but it's every day I have to push the reset button. In terms of the words that are added to the amendment, they are referred to as three insignificant words. Archimedes, when they tried to prove positive sciences, could not do on some of the things, and he went the other way. He said, let's prove negative, was the negative one. If these words are so insignificant, why are we adding them? These words mean something. In legal terms, it means a lot more than that I can figure out. But obviously, some people, the proponents of these bills, have decided by adding these three insignificant words into the bill, they can manipulate the system that they can induce control and therefore reduce the budget to less than $50 million for 4,000 people. That is the goal, and that should not be accommodated so easily, in my opinion. And I have not found anything insignificant about those three words that justifies to me that by adding those or changing those three insignificant words, we can actually challenge the QRF organizations or the commission with a simple goal. Give me 8,000 employments with $100 million. That's the goal we should be seeking for. Give me $200 million for 16,000 employment of people with severe disability. That's the goal we should have. And that's how we should measure the QRFs against. Increase the number of employments with any significant effort we put in place, not dilute the effort that has taken place. In 30 years, we grew this industry less than any industry that's grown before. For some reason, I'm finding myself to be involved with people that are afraid of growth in the nonprofit organizations. If nonprofits, if this amount of budget is so good, we invite the companies that are for-profit to join us. Go through the process of qualifying people with disability. Become nonprofit. Participate in the program and employ more people. Or better, all of the for-profit organizations should allocate 1% of their employment for people with disability. We can't even get ADA to work properly. Just imagine, if they did that, our unemployment rate in the disabled community would be equal to the unemployment rate into the able community. The disabled community unemployment rates, based on the records that we heard last week, are way in the double-digit numbers. Why are they not the same as the abled community? There is a reason behind it. It's the productivity issue. Not all for-profit companies are going to live with lower productivity levels because they are for-profit. And in terms of... I'm a proponent of the continuous improvement. And the continuous improvement process is a process that is nothing but a measurement of results. And if I was going to look back at the last 50 years' history, where the goals were not set, and I would look at the growth of the industry from $1 million to $50 million, from 98 employment to 4,000 employment, I would gather there is continuous improvement. Now think about these in three insignificant words. What does that do to the process? Is it going to double the rate of employment, or is it going to reduce it? Based on the recent results of the proponents of this on these two bills, it has started to reduce some of the contracts that was available to people with disability already. Next year, the $50 million worth of employment is down already by $15 million or $10 million. You're already going down. That is not a continuous improvement in anybody's book that I've heard before. My concern is if the motivation is to employ people with disability in jobs that provide them a fair living wage, union wage, or similar, at least above the productivity rate associated minimum wage, then let's make that a goal and measure against it. The commissions that are proposed here, and with the, of course with the running amendments, I could really not figure out what number we would reach if we follow those amendments. If we would reach 100,000 employments, that would be great. 5,000 employment, that would be 20% improvement. That would be great. But I can't conclude if those bills will reach us to that goal. I can't conclude if there is a goal. And in general, I think that we have to be aware that growth in this industry is a good thing. Growth accordingly with applying the laws to actually fulfill the requirements of the laws is a good thing. Improving those laws to allow us to grow is even a better thing. If you think that these two bills are improving the laws and allowing the industry to grow, to employ more people with disability in a non-profit environment, identified measure it every quarter. I have no problem with that. But just letting it alone and having revenge-oriented measures to destroy the process that has made improvements, albeit without my help in the last 30 years. If you stifle that growth and not allow it to be growing under the existing DAS, which is fully supervising the process, and I can attest to that, every contract we like to bid for, there is a bid process going on with DAS too. You have to actually go through a severe qualifying process. I never had to fight that hard for projects in Intel. It is extremely supervised, continuously overseen, and it is not profitable to get into it. If it was, all of these companies would join us. They have no motivation to join us, because that's not what they're here for. That's all I have to say. I hope I could help.
Thank you very much. Please.
Okay. Hi, my name is Don Carmichael. Chairman Witt, members of the committee, I came here to actually talk to you. I work at Garden Services. I just want to tell you a little bit about the folks that we serve and the things that we do there. You can still see some of the battle scars on the faces and in the memories of some of the people that work here, some of the people we serve. They remember some institutions they were in, different lifestyle. When they come to work, they get there, they're happy, we do our exercise. I like to go and do exercises with them sometimes. And I like to spend my break time and my lunch time with the people that we serve. We have a pretty nice time in the lunchroom. You see on their faces that they are very happy when they come to work. You see that they are fulfilling a need in themselves to do something better and to be something better. Some of these people have been with our company for 30 years, and on a daily basis, it is a joy to them to come to work. They come with lunch in hand, ready to do what they do. And when some people can call them people with disabilities, I call people with unique abilities. Garden works hard to find a job that that person is good at or is happy working at. And if they're not happy, we work hard to find another job for them and to try and make sure that they are where they wish to be and can be and should be. It's a daily thing that we do, and I believe we do a darn good job. I can't speak for other qualified rehabilitation facilities, but I can speak for the one that I work at, and I'm darn proud of where I work. A couple of things changed my life. When I had children, they changed my life. When I came to work at Garden Services, it changed my life. I found a higher calling and a different purpose, and I found that I can be fulfilled just going to work. And these guys give me money to do it. I found that that's a pretty good gig. I came from private industry, and I know what it's like to work a private job, and I was a safety coordinator for a large construction company. And I did my job, and I went to work every day. It had nothing on this job. This job is really special. This is a job where you can make friends. And it takes a while, but they will share with you some memories they have. They will share with you some plans that they have. We have people that are engaged, working side by side. We have people that are boyfriend and girlfriend working side by side. We have two that are engaged that are getting married in June, and I get to go and be a part of their wedding. They've asked me to, and I feel very privileged. That, to me, is a real honor. That means that they've let me into their world, and I have a chance now to make a difference with them, and they have a chance to make a difference to me. I'm learning as much as they are. When we're talking about changing anything, these guys have been doing this job for 30 years, and it seems to be working. They've got a routine that they really and truly love, and many do need. Those that wish to or get jobs in the community. And in a second, you're going to hear from my buddy Shane, and he's going to tell you about what he does. He's really good at what he does. And I won't speak for him. As a matter of fact, when I brought him here tonight, I made sure I didn't want to tell him anything. I said, he's going to figure out what he's going to say. And he does a good job of that. So I just wanted you to know that what we have now is working. And it's working so well, not just for the guys I work for, but for me. I get to be a part of their life. So it's the staff that also learns and is given a gift from the people that they work with. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
How are you all tonight? I know this brother's probably just been giving you the fits as to whether it wants to be nice or be nasty. So so let's hope that tomorrow's a sunny day, you know. And
sir,
weekend too.
Would you please give us your name?
Oh, yeah.
And if you'll just back away from the microphone a little bit, we'll come across clearer. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Shane Chandler, and I work at Garden Services, and I run a book cutter that cuts bindings off of books, and then I sort the paper from the lids and put the paper where it goes and the lids where they go, and usually find some money in those books because people don't care to take care of their money. So so they lose the money and someone gains it by finding it. Anyways, I get tired of hearing people say, oh, I quit, oh, I give up, I can't last any longer. That's a bunch of baloney. If you can last like people I know and work with have been able to last at Garden, then you know you can definitely last a long, long time working there. But when your body says, "Oh man, I have no more energy," or "I'm out of energy," where do I seek more energy? And it's like, I have to ask somebody upstairs for that energy, and he gives it to me. So I know he gives it to everybody else, but that's who I ask for my energy from, and he gives it to me. And there's not a time I've ever run out of energy. If Garden needed me till midnight just to stay busy on books, I would, you know. But yeah, that's how gifted of a person people are. Is they'll stay till midnight at a job and do what they can to make ends meet and get as many books out of boxes and cut up and sorted and done, you know. And of course, it's their time to go home. Then they gotta come back the next day and do it over again, right? And so, it's not easy, but the person that has the job is making a difference. And I think, like you said, I am making a big difference. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Folks, I'm going to have to ask that the audience...
Does the chair have any questions?
Yes, we will. Just a second, please. That the audience would please refrain from applause. And I'm going to ask for your assistance in helping to respect the decorum here of the hearings process. Questions of our panel? Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the two gentlemen who are staff, I guess, at the facilities, are the folks that you have at your facilities, both of you, are they severely disabled folks?
In our facility, I run the industrial division for Portland Rehabilitation Center. And we employ about 60 people in my department. Out of the 60 people, we probably have about 15 people with severe autism. We have several people with physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. We have about 24 people with such a severe disability that they are on a voluntary workforce. They do what they please to do, mm-hmm. and when they want to do.
Sure.
And then we have several people, and by work I mean we provide bulk material for them. For example, Home Depot. They have these pipes that they bring from China, and they have to add labels to it.
Right.
So we set it for them so they can do it at their leisure. And once we're done with filling the box, we send it back. The one box may take 10 hours, one bike may take 1 hour. And we just don't pressure them.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is 99% of the people that work on the floor mm-hmm. are people with disability that are considered to me severe. Let me put it this way.
Good.
They have it better than I have in many cases. They feel good.
Thank you.
My job at Garden is in a sales capacity, so all I can speak to you about is what I've seen. I do give tours of our facility, and those on the sort floor in recycling, which is the building that I specifically work in, have severe disabilities. We have a couple that are higher functioning, what would be termed higher functioning, and they actually have different jobs, one driving forklift, and one that sweeps a large warehouse that has a lot of heavy equipment moving around in there. Those guys have a continued pattern of not being able to make it in the general public in jobs and have come back to work at Garden, both of them.
So 80-90% at least.
Exactly, at least.
Thank you.
It's a bit severe.
Yes, I understand. Thank you.
I work with a guy whose name is Mike Abel, and he comes in on a carry lift or whatever, and his whole routine is he'll come and clock in, come and stack me some books, walk off, go somewhere, come back, stack me some more books, walk off, and go somewhere. You never can tell whether he wants to stay and work till it's break time or he wants to, you know, do his own thing. And like the guy opposite side of Don said, yeah, there's people that do that too. And so, yeah, Mike Cable's one of them that, like I said, will come in, do a little book stack and leave, come back, do a little book stack and leave, you know. Mm-hmm. Can't keep them there all day long. They're paid different than what I'm paid, which is to stay there the 4.5 hours in the morning and get all the books I can cut up and lids done and paper done and you know, then go home. And I can't make him stay there and just plain stack those books for me because he's doing his own thing. So
thank you.
If that answers...
It does. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Additional questions? Masood, you had mentioned the figure 4,000 people employed, which is what we heard from the last time. And you mentioned that employment was at union scale.
The 4,000 number that was brought up was for the global QRF population for the state of Oregon.
And the scale is at your
I am not at all familiar with the entire population. I'm talking about the PHC.
Okay.
We pay union wages. They're actually members of the union.
Okay.
And we pay benefits. We pay dentals, medical, vacation, holiday, everything. It's run well.
Very good.
And I wouldn't join it.
Have you had anybody come and find the job not going and wonder why did I get left there?
At the job?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. We'll help them though.
Could you tell me? Is there an average wage scale that's paid at your facility?
In the industry, in our facility.
In your...
But the union wages, obviously, are... I would say that on the average, without having the data to refer to accurately, I would give you a range. It's between probably $10 to $15 an hour.
Okay. And would that be...
That's not include the benefits, okay. Not the holidays, not the vacations, and etc. It's not more. And some of the contracts that we have, they actually pay more than less based on the value of the contract. Some of the wages are determined by the federal organizations, not by us. They decide what the living wage is. And we actually pay them what they decide that the living wage is. And the people that have severe disabilities, they can function differently in different jobs. It takes a lot of manufacturing engineering to find the right jobs for them. Not everybody can plug the wires into an electrical assembly, but if you do the right templates for them and sequence it properly, they can. It's managing those kind of jobs is not as easy as managing not those kind of jobs. It's more work.
Now, you had talked earlier in the beginning of your testimony that roughly, if you split that $50 million out, that it's roughly $12,000 a year.
Plus.
There are obviously some QRFs based on those figures that pay substantially less than what yours does.
I cannot tell you what they do. What I can tell you is based on industry's averages, and when you calculate numbers, basically what we did per head is if any employee at Intel did not generate more than $1.1 million of revenue, mm-hmm. that division had to be closed. We're talking about per head, $12,000 of revenue. All those divisions have to be closed
sure.
if you're thinking about profit making. So when you do an average calculation on any business study, you have to go with means and averages. This is not a very fulfilling industry from a banker's point of view.
Yes. And we had testimony the last time that there are some QRFs that pay substantially less than, or at least the clients receive substantially less than minimum wage.
The productivity dependencies you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, it is absolutely true. And the way it works is that there's a process that you have to go to substantiate on that wage level. The substantiation process is a surveying of the open market for specific jobs, averaging those out, and establishing an hourly rate for a specific function in the company, and then measuring those tasks that are temporary tasks generally, because not you can't build 5,000 of them. Anything that's more than 5,000 goes to China anyhow. So we're talking about niche markets. Then you do a time study based on three people in your environment, not necessarily disabled, and you time the process of those people, how fast can they assemble the product, to measure the productivity rate for a specific task. And then you have people with severe disability. Like I mentioned, it takes about 2 or 3 hours to pair up two shoelaces. We go based on the counts that that person can generate in a day. And based on their productivity rate, you assign a wage, hourly wage, that you already surveyed, and they would deserve a portion of that. In those cases, which is, by the way, very minimal, because those are generally is a very small percentage of your population, they can't get their own paycheck anyhow because they don't know what it says. So you have to have other affiliates of their families to make sure that they get their paychecks. That is the beauty of the job. Those people that make so little, mm-hmm. if it's little, to them it's so much, the way they handle that paycheck with that pride as they walk away and they just pat each other on the back. That's what you don't see in your jobs. That's what we see in our job. When they come and put their head on your chest and just hug you, it's not a typical lifestyle. That's why it's not a typical job. Those guys are having a great time. You have to accommodate them. You can't send them back in the street because they can only do 6 pairs of shoelaces a day. That's not the function. The function is employ them, bring them in, train them, give them the progression path. It's a harder work to manage them than typical high-efficiency workforce. Because in order for your company to survive, you have to find things that all people can do. Therefore, it takes a lot more industrial engineering techniques, in my field at least, to make sure that they're capable of doing it. And we're not stopping. Growth is the name of our game. In order for us to succeed, and success for us means employ more people with disability, not make more money, we have to give them tasks that are Six Sigma ready, prevent mistakes, and make them successful in the process by automating them through software development programs, automating their tasks that they catch their errors ahead of the final shipment. It's actually a very challenging task. It can work. It can really work.
with the benefit of productivity considerations, if a wage is being paid substantially less, perhaps even one-third of the minimum wage, roughly, would it be reasonable to expect that you might want to try and employ three times as many people to have that same kind of earnings gratification?
If we could, that would be great. If the better thing would be to be able to get that person that has a low productivity and by training increase their productivity so they can actually earn more and just have a bigger smile. Our priority in our system is to get the training involved first and try to get them at a higher level of efficiency for one purpose and one purpose alone. The purpose is employment with independent living and potential employment outside of the QRF environment. A lot of the people, we're doing it. Like, for example, we have people that are we're not training for manufacturing floor control. They may be on a wheelchair, but they can manage a manufacturing floor by being in charge of other people. And those are just the improvement paths that I think we should embed into the system. And not, without the growth system, it won't come. If you design a business based on poverty, it will just go one direction, as you all know. It's just down.
Thank you all very, very much. Certainly appreciate. Oh, excuse me, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, you know, our previous speakers talked of the Department of Corrections qualifying as a QRF and employing folks inside the prisons and competing for contracts. Do you know, does your organization or the Oregon Rehabilitation Association have a position on that practice or on the Department of Corrections also qualifying as QRF?
I am not aware of it, but I'm sure there are people that can speak to that effect. But I want to caution you that in my years, I've heard that they have a saying that if sometimes I have to shave my mustache so I don't get considered to be a terrorist, right? And there, you, they can take one example that is awfully suspicious and try to get the whole picture painted based on the brush they used on that one example. So if there is a bad apple, don't kill the system. Take out the bad apple. And there are systems in place that can accommodate that task for you at the present time. The three significant words, the insignificant words, are significant, and believe me, it's not trying to deal with the bad apple.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment, you know, and wasn't trying to paint the entire industry with that bad apple. I was just wanting to know what your position whether it's a bad apple or not, I guess.
Well, I don't know if it's a bad apple. But to me, my personal view, without thinking about it so deeply, because I've never heard about this situation before, so in the last 5 minutes of contemplation, I would say that any person or any human being on this earth that has severe disability has to be able to work throughout their life to get somewhere. If they happen to be in the prison system, if the laws of the prison systems are allowing them to get to that point, that's fantastic. After all, it's called rehabilitation process. That's how it started, not a punishment system. If we can provide them that ability to gain some skills and while they're disabled and grow, so then they come out, they don't get into trouble, I think that's wonderful. But whether that is the majority population of the QRFs, I can guarantee you it's not. That I know.
Panel members, thank you very, very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
On the list, is there anybody from DAS that's going to testify?
There's no one that has signed up here that has identified themselves as being from DAS this evening.
And then the advocacy, Oregon Advocacy Council, is their attorney signed up to speak?
If there is, that person hadn't identified themselves as an attorney. Feel free to ask. Yes, it appears.
And then, is he signed up?
Have you signed up to that?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I'll tell you where I'm going is if there has been prison labor or if there has been a situation where the QRF is out of bounds and there's been lawsuit or action taken, perhaps they could give us some notion of how many times that is. That's where I was going with that, but I'll wait.
Okay, thank you. And committee members, just for the purposes of accuracy, I know that in our last hearing, it was generally assumed that there were 4,000 people employed under PDIL, and the Department of Administrative Services sent me a letter today that lists the number as of 2006 as 6,828. With that, I would like to please call up next Pamela Hewitt, Sandra West, and Ken Garinger, please.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I don't know.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Please feel free to proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pam Hewitt. I am the Employment Services Director for Spruce Villa. We provide employment services for approximately 85 adults with developmental disabilities in Marion, Polk, and Linn counties. Because of the Products with Disabled Individuals Law, Spruce Villa was able to bid for and obtain landscape and janitorial contracts from local governments to employ 21 adults. These adults qualify to work on these contracts because they have a documented disability that substantially limits at least one major life activity. These determinations are made by the County Developmental Disabilities Program prior to their receiving services from Spruce Villa. Additional determinations of disability are made by the Social Security Administration and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Annual review of the documentation of disability is completed by a CPA and provided to DAS per OAR. We have never received a determination that the disabled workers were not qualified. Additional determinations may be perceived as discriminatory and humiliating to the individual and at the very least wasteful of the OHP resources. They are not able to participate fully in competitive employment with reasonable accommodations. These adults are paid under a subminimum wage certificate with the Department of Labor. Their productivity is not competitive even with reasonable accommodation. The individuals that we serve value working competitive employment and are proud to be contributing members of the community. I am a member of the advisory committee for the PDI law as established by DAS. I understand that our purpose is to further the policy of the state to encourage and assist people with disabilities who cannot compete in the workforce in finding useful and productive gainful employment. I believe that including labor organizations would be of great assistance in achieving this goal. Perhaps together we could find a way to employ all people with disabilities in private business or government and no longer have a need for laws like PDI. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you this evening. My name is Sandra West, and I work with a medium-sized employment and support agency named Center Enterprises. We provide services to adults, all of whom have developmental disabilities, and many of whom have additional mental and physical conditions, such as epilepsy, heart conditions, orthopedic limitations, and other similar conditions that impact their work and productivity abilities. We are located in Albany in Linn County. Our agency is certified as a QRF and meets the annual requirements to maintain this status. Currently, we perform janitorial and confidential shredding services for state agencies. The contracts we have with state agencies provide expanded opportunities for individuals to perform work and earn wages in their local communities. We employ 10 people who provide janitorial services in two crews that move from one work site to another daily. None of these individuals drive. All require supervision to travel and work safely. Many require assistance with taking medication if required during work hours. Some require frequent reminders and reinforcement during work hours. All, however, take pride in performing required tasks such as cleaning bathrooms, vacuuming, dusting, removing trash, and other similar routine jobs. They perform these to specification standards required by the contract. And all individuals so employed take great pride in receiving a paycheck, which is possible only because they are employed by a QRF. Competitive employers have consistently refused to employ this population due to the extra resources required for their ongoing employment and support. The products of the disabled law makes it possible for these individuals to work and contribute based on their abilities, no matter how limited. Individuals with developmental disabilities who, because of additional physical disabilities or age-related limitations, likewise value the opportunities to perform confidential shredding within our facility. Performing the tasks required to accomplish the shredding and document destruction provides individuals with opportunities to perform various parts of tasks while seated, with physical assistance or frequent rest periods when needed, and ongoing support for safety, medical, or behavioral issues. The work provides almost 20 individuals who perform this task part of each day with a means of earning a monthly paycheck, again, something each and every individual values. Current administration and procedure through the Department of Administrative Services, DAS, has a track record that has been tested. Likewise, transparency is already required of DAS and of QRFs who contract under this law through the annual independent audits, detailed price determination workbooks for each contract, annual applications, and requests for public postings for suitability for products and services. These bills would only replace DAS with a new, untested bureaucracy that is likely to be more expensive, inefficient, and counterproductive without providing any additional light on the subject. Based on the current experience of Center Enterprises, we do not see that either HB 2732 or HB 2842 would augment the purpose or intent of the current law, which is to, quote, further the policy of this state to encourage and assist disabled individuals to achieve maximum personal independence through useful and productive gainful employment by ensuring an expanded and constant market for sheltered workshop and activity center products and services, thereby enhancing the dignity and capacity for self-support and minimizing dependence on welfare and need for costly institutionalization. I therefore respectfully urge the committee to oppose HB 2732 and HB 2842. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Ken Geringer, and I work for Portland Habilitation Center, and I am severely disabled. I'm legally blind from a progressive eye disease. That's my vision, degrees of vision is cut down to less than 10%. And Portland Habilitation Center has really made a huge difference in my life in giving me employment. When I initially lost my ability to work in the normal, in the regular workforce, that was about 6 years ago, and I wasn't employed for a full 4 years. And I started working with Portland Habilitation Center, and I was seeing how much they've helped not just myself, but many other people that I work with. It's a great program, and I would hate to see anything happen that would change that. There's many people there that really, and myself included, that would not be able to go into the regular workforce and be afforded the same chances at work as I get from Portland Rehabilitation Center. And also, I have worked in the past with developmentally disabled people that worked in some of these other sheltered workshops and saw the huge difference that that made in their life. And so in both places I've seen this. Just the ability to actually go out there and make money and feel important and not feel like they're left behind is just makes a tremendous difference in everybody's lives. And I really appreciate that the present program exists and that people have stood up and have tried to help people. Like I said, there's many people I work with that would not be able to compete in the normal workforce, and myself included. By being able to work there, I don't have to, if I tried to go into the regular workforce and get a job, I know I would have to try and hide my disability. And that's actually what I did before I became determined to be disabled. It was really difficult. It was a tremendous stress on me to try and hide that I couldn't see well. And this company not only helps ease that stress, but they try to accommodate me. And it's a progressive disease. It's just going to get worse. And I know that I wouldn't be able to work any other place. And these programs are very important. And I appreciate that they're there. And I don't want to see anything happen to change that.
Thank you very much, Representative Dolan.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm sorry, I missed you. You run one of the QRFs, or manage it, the one in Albany?
Yes, yes, Sandra West is my name.
Say it again.
Sandra West.
Sandra, I'm sorry, I wrote
it
down. But what I want to ask you is, and I have a very dear friend that's similarly situated to yourself, and I asked her the same thing today. Can you imagine, with the people that you have employed in your operation, anyone, by any definition, not defining them as in need of this service?
I can't, sir.
Thank you. I wish I'd asked that of more, but so regardless of what the definition is, and we have three or four of them that are legal, people that work for you would qualify. If you say disabled, they would qualify.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Sandra. It was a well-prepared testimony.
Thank you.
My question is, are they working hourly, or do they work by their piecework, or by the job? How do they work?
It depends on the job. For those individuals who work in our janitorial unit, they work on an hourly basis. The people who perform the shredding operation do it on a per pound basis, which is a piece rated basis.
Okay, additional questions?
Please.
Any one of them working under this program, are they getting public assistance and then getting plus out of this job, making some additional money? What's the situation?
Representative Lim, Chairman Witt, it varies from person to person. Certainly some individuals may be receiving financial assistance through supplemental security income and other resources, even Social Security benefits on a deceased parent or retired parent. So their financial situation varies. Their earnings, however, are reported and tracked by those agencies providing financial assistance, and when necessary, contributions are made to their care or deducted from the financial assistance they receive. So it depends on the individual. Some of the individuals we work with probably don't earn enough on a monthly basis to contribute substantively to their self-care.
Okay.
Others may indeed be contributing more.
Additional questions, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Do they work usually 8 hours full-time, or 4 hours, or 2 hours? Or what's the average hours are they working?
Okay. Chairman Witt, Representative Lim, that again varies greatly from individual to individual. We don't have any individuals right now that are working 8 hours per day. We have people who work janitorial as many as 4 or 5 hours daily. We have individuals in the facility performing the shredding operation, some of whom only work a half hour a day. Others work on a more continuous basis. It depends on their individual abilities, their physical and mental capabilities, and also their choice.
Okay, thank you. My comment, Mr. Chair?
Please.
My comment is, when we are talking about $50 million and the 6,200, did you mention that?
6,800, Vice Chairman.
6,800. Which means per person about $8,000, if my math calculation may be up and down, you know. But so if it's divided by that number, it could be around $8,000 per person. But considering the time they are working, we need to figure out the time, how much total times involved in it, then we don't know exact pictures of how much they are getting paid. And so 6,800, 7,000, that's not the issue to me. By the total hours they are working, when we divide it, then it will show me exactly how much they are getting paid, and plus what actual cost of administration plus others. So I don't have any clear picture at this time yet.
Thank you, Vice Chair Lim.
Sandrin, excuse me for the familiarity, but through the course of the last week or two, I've gotten very deeply involved in this. If someone were to come and watch your operation and be put in a position of authority, do you have any fear at all that if you had time to explain the program, that anybody would let any of your employees go?
Because they didn't.
If they came and watched your QRF, uh-huh, and watched your people work and understood the system and talked with you for 10 minutes, a half hour, do you think anybody would let any of your people go?
If I understand what you're asking me, no.
No,
They all need the supports that we provide and the opportunities provided through the QRF.
And for those that a visual doesn't provide an obvious definition, talking with you for a minute would reassure them that the people there need the work and that they belong in the program.
I have no doubt that the visual would come through loud and clear, and then talking with the individuals themselves would cement the situation, cement the decision that they all belong there.
Thank you very much again.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, panel members. Next, I'd like to call up Anthony. I'm going to try this. Is it Munoz? Something close to that. Linda Rodriguez and Cindy Stockton, please. Good evening. Please proceed in what order you prefer.
My name is Anthony Munoz. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, of course. I'm not a public speaker, so I hope I don't mess up.
Well, you're doing fine.
I worked 3 years at PHC, the Portland Habilitation Center, dealing with people of various disabilities. 340 of our people are employed with the Portland Public Schools and with the city park system. disability program should be expanded, I believe. Expanded probably to include our highest group, which is our fastest growing group, which is United States veterans coming back from the war who are injured. This is a group that's going to be increasing, I believe. And also people from the Eastern Bloc who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's unfair and un-American to neglect a portion of our population due to disability. And all people are trainable and are valuable. As for what they get paid, my custodians that work for me get paid $10.35 an hour, which is a livable wage. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Linda Rodriguez, and I work for PHC. I was one of the custodians at the schools for a while. I now work at the airport. This is something I need, so that I can work. I have been in the service, and I'm no longer in the service because of the fact that I have the post-traumatic stress and the panic attack anxiety attack. I have lost jobs before because of it, and this job here, at least if I have problems, they don't fire me. I am very happy with this job, and I'm really, this is something that is really important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Representative Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Stockton. I'm the Executive Director of Riverside Training Centers in St. Helens, Oregon, Columbia County. We're in Representative Chairs or Representative Witt's District. I also serve on the board of the Oregon Rehab Association. And I spent a bunch of time trying to prepare for this. I'm a little nervous. And I thought, you know, you've heard so many facts over the last couple of times that people have had an opportunity to speak, that I thought, rather than try to be an expert on something that I'm not, I want to share with you the really important piece of the products of the Disabled Individuals Law, and that's the opportunity that people who would not otherwise have to work that this provides. One of the folks that works on one of our contracts, which has been procured through this law, it's a janitorial contract. Every Monday, he tells me, I'm still employed, I'm still going to work. And I said, that's great, Johnny. And we talk about how his weekend went. And then the next Friday of that same week, he says, I'm going to work on Sunday. I mean, that means so much to him. And it means so much to me that I can be a part of that. I'm not sure if it's okay. There were a couple of questions that were posed, and I would like to share a little bit of information about those. The subminimum wage that is referenced in piece rates, those are regulated by the Department of Labor. And so even though people may make less than minimum wage, there's a process that we as agencies have to go through to be able to do that, and it's fair. And somebody may make, the subminimum wage is based on a prevailing wage, so it's typically more than minimum wage. So if somebody is getting paid maybe one-third of what you or I might be paid for the same work, it's based on actually more than minimum wage. And in terms of piece rate, people are paid based on what a typical worker would be able to do in a reasonable amount of time, and they factor in fatigue and distraction. So it's not that, you know, you and I are quickly doing as many as we can in an hour to set a rate. It's what a typical person could do hour after hour and day after day. And so if an individual with disabilities or a person without disabilities were paid on piece rate, they still have an opportunity to make minimum wage or more. There are businesses that are not QRFs that pay on piece rate. So I just wanted to clarify that. The other piece that I keep hearing about is the $50 million that are currently being the $50 million for the current contracts and how many people work and how many dollars per hour that equates to. The piece that's getting left out of that, and have you had an opportunity to receive the costing workbook that we're required to use through the Department of Administrative Services? If you look at the costing workbook, that $50 million isn't just wages. It's benefits, it's oversight, it's transportation, it's supplies, it's everything. So I want to make sure that we're clear that $50 million isn't just wages being distributed among 6,800 people. It's the total cost of doing the job. So, like I said, I don't have every answer to every question, but I know what this means for people. And I think if business and labor want to be involved in this process, they should join the advisory committee. I don't think we need to create new legislation and change laws to fix what's not broken. And if I can just ask you to do one thing, it's vote with your consciences. In the not too recent past, people with disabilities were put in institutions and forgotten. And I'm afraid that if we pass House Bills 2732 and 2842, we're going to do the same thing with their employment. And I ask you to please consider that.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Thank you very much, other panel members. Questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much. Robert, it looks like Ostoff, and Deborah Lindsay. And I'd also ask up Jack June, please.
No.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Deborah Lindsay. I'm the Director of Person-Centered Services with Partnerships in Community Living. We're a nonprofit that serves over 100 people in work and in residential in Marion, Polk County, and several other counties. Before that, I was the assistant director with Coast Rehabilitation in Astoria. And before that, I was the executive director of Midcoast Enterprises in Florence, Oregon, for over 9 years. All of these nonprofits have benefited from the products of the disabled law. In Florence, we served all the state parks with firewood successfully for many years. We did several thousand square feet of janitorial every evening. And in Astoria, we also did several thousand square feet of janitorial every evening in public offices. All of these were served with people with severe disabilities. Right now, the company I work for has people who work in a laundry business, as watches, uniforms, and for public agencies. I've seen how important the law is to people with disabilities and the organizations that serve them, and I, like you, have sat through many hours of testimonies on how important the law is and how concerned we are that these bills will take away jobs or eliminate new possibilities. In my role as the residential chair of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association Board of Directors, I hear from QRFs across the state their concerns on these bills. I've also participated for many years in protecting this law. We've heard some people say that we are overreacting. Perhaps we don't understand the changes that their bills represent and that they won't hurt anything. We also hear concern from that maybe the association of which I'm on the board of has whipped QRFs and people with disabilities into a frenzy over very small changes that won't hurt us. That couldn't be further from the case. All of us fully understand and are very clear at what's at stake with these proposed changes with the law. We see right through the language that attempts to cover up the true intent of these bills. You might wonder why we're so concerned, why we're worried about these bills, especially when we hear testimony that their intent is really to bring fairness and input into business and organized labor into the process, even to the point of saying that the input would somehow improve the process. Why do we remain concerned in spite of the new rhetoric from the businesses and laborers, because we know from working with people for many years that the best indication of what someone is going to do in the future is what they've done in the past. So when we look at the past, over the last several years, what we can see is that last session, two bills were supported. One would have killed the law entirely, while the other would have attempted to take all the education from the law. In the previous sessions, businesses introduced bills that would have restricted the definition of the eligibility under the law to those with disabilities that are so severe that no work could have been done under the law, and others would have exempted the mail services from the law or simply tried to kill the law. And when not introducing bills to kill or restrict the law, businesses and laborers have filed numerous lawsuits and legal challenges to the rules governing the law and the individual contracts under the law, their arguments being the same as those you've heard in this session, and all have been reviewed and directed and rejected by the courts. Some of the concerns that we hear are that the law's definition is unclear or too broad, that it's drifted from its original mission, that DAS rules are unclear and go beyond the legislative intent. There are hundreds of thousands of people with disabilities who will take all the public work away. That DAS doesn't do any monitoring of the QRFs. That individuals with disabilities working on specific contracts like Garten or Portland Public Schools are really not disabled, and that they got access to, but when they got access to the individual records to review those specific cases, their own experts could never prove the assertions that these people were not disabled. The courts have reviewed and rejected these and other arguments raised in the efforts to prove the law was unfairly administrated or too broadly interpreted. In fact, in every instance, the courts have upheld this law, its rules, and how it's being implemented. Now, after 10 years of legislation and legal battles, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend, we suddenly hear that businesses and laborers have seen the light and have just realized that their true goals are to expand work for the people with disabilities. After 10 years of showing their true colors, we're just not buying it, and neither should you. They're attempting to wrap their newfound commitment to employment with people with disabilities in language in a commission that would, and make no mistake about it, absolutely control the future of the products of the disabled law. By granting the commission rulemaking authority, the authority to determine the work that falls under the law, and the authority to write and administer appeals and dispute processes, this bill would transfer all the real authority to a group of vested interest individuals, nearly half of whom would come from ranks of the groups who have already clearly demonstrated their commitment to restricting the work under the law. The language of the commission says that the commission would somehow be able to develop policies and set policy for identifying and serving individuals with disabilities to be gainfully employed in a competitive marketplace. This truly is outside their scope and their purpose. It has nothing to do with how the law operates and how it's administered within DAS. The commission's sole authority would be set policy and rule for the PDI law. Everything else you see would be just a window dressing. Business and law say that somehow the commission would affect policy across the Department of State, Human Services, and Employment, etc., disregarding the fact that there are and have been many years advisory bodies within the state, many agencies who have been working on this very issue. For example, the State of Rehabilitation Advisory Council for the Vocational Rehabilitation, the Special Education Advisory Council for the Education, the Deaf and Hearing Impaired Program, the Advisory Council for People with Physical Disabilities, and the Mental Health Advisory Board, and many others. I wonder if the committee knows that Oregon currently has a cross-disability advisory group working on promoting employment for people with disabilities. This leadership council advises the Oregon Competitive Employment Project, whose mission is to enhance the quality of life in Oregon by achieving, maintaining, and advancing the competitive employment of people with disabilities. All stakeholders, including business, are represented in this council. And they're there is the Oregon Disabilities Commission, which is just another cross-disability advisory committee within DHS that will be advising the department on broad range of public policy, including employment. At this point, it is very clear that business and labor have no idea who's promoting employment for people with disabilities, and their only concern is restricting the access to work under the PDIO. In fact, Mr. Wilson sounded last Friday like a born-again rehabber on the suddenly discovering that employment for people with disabilities is a real problem. Business and labor should stick to the real issue that they are truly concerned about, controlling the PDIO. By rewriting the administrative rules already, the most stringent in the country, and which have been court-tested at the cost of more than $500,000. We find it even more astounding that business and labor propose getting 4 out of 9 votes on this commission. This commission would actually be determining what contracts are suitable for their, in their opinion, to fall under the law, the prices of those contracts, and how to appeal, which would mostly come from business and labor, and how it should be handled. Their most recent concession, when it apparently discovered that the law applied to people with disabilities, not just developmental disabilities, was not to increase the number of people knowledgeable about those disability groups, but to specifically let the disability groups figure out who among them would be in the 5 remaining seats of the advisory council. Where are the other state agencies whose business and employment for people with disabilities? Where are the workers with disabilities who have the most at stake, and where are their families? Where are the QRFs? Somehow the bill plans to give business and labor to 4 out of 9 seats, but leaves QRFs completely out of the picture. And yet the law specifically says that the intent of the Legislative Assembly, it is the intent of the Legislative Assembly that there be close cooperation between the department, public contracting agencies, and QRFs. This approach is blatantly flawed, and in our opinion, it is unfair and biased to the degree of control that we urge you to either rewrite it completely or simply reject it in its present state. Indeed, if the bill did what the proponent says it does, help job opportunities for people with disability advocates, we would all rush to support it. As it is, disability advocate groups oppose this bill. They know the intent is not to help them, but to harm their jobs for the people with disabilities. Thank you.
Next, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Stuva. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to testify on HB 2842 and the proposed amendments. From 1991 and through 2001, I served as the Executive Director of Rehabilitation for Wisconsin, a similar organization to ORA here in Oregon, and was very much involved in the creation of Wisconsin state use law. It's my understanding that the legislation before you was based on the Wisconsin state use model. The original legislation was drafted by members of the Senate and the House at the request of our trade association, and it passed through both the House and the Senate almost unanimously. When it reached Governor Tommy Thompson's office, the legislation that would have established the central nonprofit or commission with powers very similar to those contained in HB 2842 was vetoed by the governor. The governor of Wisconsin has line item veto authority, and Tommy decimated the legislation with his veto pen. While we were extremely disappointed with Governor Thompson's decision, we had very little room to argue with his reasoning behind the veto. Governor Thompson felt that he could not delegate the purchasing power of the state of Wisconsin to an individual or a commission who are not either elected by the citizens of Wisconsin or employed by the state of Wisconsin with the authority to encumber state funding for purchasing and to make policy. To him, it did not matter if this commission was to award funding to a QRF or to a bridge builder. He rightfully claimed that this responsibility could not and should not be delegated to any appointed board or commission. I urge you to think about this. Do you really want two representatives from private nonprofit rehabilitation facilities, as the first legislation proposed, two representatives from the private business council, and a labor representative, along with representatives from local government and the general public, encumbering funds on behalf of the state of Oregon? Governor Thompson felt that the power to award the contract rested with his Department of Administrative Services, the university systems that had purchasing agents, and the Department of Transportation, not boards or commissions. I feel that the legislation you have in front of you may be similarly flawed. I do not believe it would be wise to relinquish that power given to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to a commission as described in HB 2842. At a minimum, I would urge you to request that this legislation be reviewed by the Attorney General's office for its legal and financial implications. Wisconsin now has an advisory commission known as the State Use Board. It does provide advice to DAS, but the ultimate decisions rest with DAS. The board does provide guidance and direction. It does get involved with disputed set-aside projects, and it helps identify potential and appropriate work for qualified QRFs. But it does not award the contract, and it does not set policy. Finally, one thought. I've been in the field of rehabilitation for over 40 years. Now, that's why I have to have a different set of glasses to see what my notes say. God knows that QRFs are not perfect and that occasionally we step on the toes of small business in our communities. But from the years of service, and particularly the years of services working in Wisconsin with over 100 QRFs, I can say to you unequivocally that for every business that has had a bad relationship with a QRF, there are at least 25 others that support the QRFs and use the QRFs to benefit their bottom line. In Oregon, QRFs build computers, produce parts for Freightliner trucks, work with cardboard products for Weyerhaeuser, build safety kits for Les Schwab and Warren Industries, manufacture pallets for many companies, and do a lot of tasks for Nike. Those companies have seen the value of QRFs and the value of working with QRFs to employ people with disabilities. Virtually every major industry in Oregon has a tie to community rehabilitation facilities, either through subcontracting work to the QRF or by corporate contributions to those QRFs. Despite this support, people with disabilities are still underemployed, and I believe the state of Oregon can do more to help eliminate unemployment and underemployment of persons with disabilities. Oregon State Use Program is an important commitment among many that should be enhanced and actively used to help eliminate the old stereotype that only certain jobs can be done by individuals with disabilities. In my opinion, the present law is adequate. There may be a need for restructuring of an advisory committee, and I urge you to consider that in your deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jack June, and I own DJ Testing on Market Street. I also have a letter from Bob Jacobson from Umpqua Homes. He asked me to bring it, and do you want me to read it, or you want to just have your copy up there?
If you could just summarize for us maybe his comments and give us your own.
I'll do that. He says he's been a member of NFIB for many years. and he feels that the interests of his organization in the past have been represented by NFIB. He basically wanted the committee to know that NFIB does not represent him in this matter. And he urges a no vote on House Bill 2732 and 2842.
Thank you.
Okay. So I've been a member of NFIB also for the last several years. In fact, they ran across the parking lot from me. And I didn't know anything about this until a few days ago. So I don't know what's going on there. I'm very familiar with the products and label law in Oregon. But I just heard about this 2842 and that proposes the drastic changes in the current law. I have reviewed these changes, and I believe the purpose is to get the law that has given many disabled persons a chance to improve themselves. Creating another bureaucracy would make it almost impossible to ever negotiate a contract, and in my opinion would take jobs away from disabled individuals. In addition, it would be an increasing financial burden on the Department of Administrative Services. I have known disabled persons who started out working in a rehab company or a work center. They gained some skills. They got some confidence. Now they're working in the community. And I have breakfast with several of them about once a week at White's Restaurant. So if you ever go down there, you can stop by and you'll readily recognize these people. I applaud the companies that gave them a chance and not just complaining about their lost contract. There is no purchasing entity that I know of that can guarantee that if the law is changed, the proponents of this legislation would benefit. On the other hand, it's a foregone conclusion that if defeated, people with disabilities will benefit. Therefore, I recommend that the definition of disability remain the same so that the persons can fully participate in the workforce. I also urge you to defeat these poorly constructed bills. I believe House Bill 2842 and 2732 will take jobs away from some of our most vulnerable citizens. Please vote no on these two bills.
Thank you very much. Representative Dahl?
I have a question. The Wisconsin program.
Yes.
Right now, the Wisconsin program has a private business general representative and then a private business small representative. So the relationship with their board to the QFR, they do have a business representative. Do you know, do they have a representative from labor?
At one time, again, I've been away for 10 years, a representative from labor was on the board. It was not required. It was the governor nominated that individual as a member at large. I'm not quite sure what the title was, but and there were the board had a number of state agency representatives on it. There was a small veterans and minority business representative on the advisory board. There was a representative from the Vocational Rehabilitation Division on the board.
Still
and a
there.
Representative from DAS on the board.
And did the board in Wisconsin have rulemaking authority?
No.
Thank you.
They had input, but the final decision and wording was up to DAS, and in several cases, DAS would overrule the committee.
What about policy? Policy making authority?
No.
Contract review? I think you answered that in your testimony.
Only if disputed or if it was going to be have a major impact on an industry, would it go before the council, the committee? And there were debates, and there were some that the QRFs did not win because of those overriding issues of eliminating too many jobs or in a particular industry, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, I will go through the format. May I follow up one more time?
Please.
With the inclusion of labor
and the inclusion of small business on the board, did that seem to mitigate some of the angst with business on losing contracts and labor on losing jobs?
In time, yes.
Thank you very much.
Not seeing any other questions. Thank you very much. I'd just like to let all of our witnesses know that I intend to conclude these hearings at 9 o'clock. If everyone takes 3 minutes each, we will have more than enough time to get everybody on. If you take more than 3 minutes, your minutes are going into somebody else's time slot, and the people at the end of the list are probably going to be angry. So I would urge you to keep that in mind as you present your testimony. Please don't make that person at the end of the list angry. With that, I'd like to call up Virginia Hill, Ross Ryan, and Tony Newton, please. Good evening.
Good evening. Okay. Hello, my name is Virginia Hill. I live and work in Mount Angel, Oregon. I have my own apartment. I have two cats, Tigger and Kanga. I have been put down and labeled. I've been judged by the color of my skin. Because of my gender, because people say I'm disabled. Let me tell you who I am. I am a hard-working woman who is proud of who I am. I am a citizen of the United States. I am entitled to my rights. I should not be judged because of the color of my skin or by my IQ. I believe that people should treat others fairly. These bills are not fair to me. With a little help, I can make it. Not take the help away. People do not understand that I can be as good a worker as any other person. I demand to be treated with dignity and respect. I have the right to work.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tony Newton. I propose the House Bill 237 and 280-42. I am a very strong Christian. I love animals very much. I have a cat and a rabbit that are my kids. I live in Mount Angel. I love that town. I work in the training center. I started walking dogs at the Humane Society and doing other such things, such as cleaning up as a volunteer. Then they hired other people to clean up without hiring me because of my disability. I really didn't think that was right. Sunnyside Care Center. I started as a volunteer. I was doing all kinds of things, all kinds of work there. I was calling bingo, helping with birthday parties, wheeling people around, doing all sorts of stuff. they hired somebody else to call bingo. I was not treated as an equal worker. I was a good hard worker. I now have a job, and I work activity center. I love my job. I make a paycheck. Please don't take the bills that threaten my job and paycheck. Don't look at the disability. Look what the person can do.
Hello, my name is Ross Ryan. I'm the part of the self-advocacy leaders, and I'm on the policy committee. And I am a sergeant of arms at the Victory Alliance. And I have a black belt of Taekwondo. A friend and I like to go to Bible studies and movies. My family support me in any way they can. My friends and I help one another. I was labeled with a developmental disability in 1969 or 1970. It was inconsiderate and rude for someone else to label me because I was slightly different. It had been hard when people made fun of me. I graduated in the class of 90. After high school, I was working at Rock IGH for 4 hours a day. I was working in the back with the cans and bottles. I didn't have anybody that had the time to support me. I kept on wanting to leave early. I was let go because I was leaving early. I have also worked at the Mount Angel Abbey. I was let go. I have been working at the Mount Angel Developmental Program. I think it was since 1993. I have been able to keep my job with the support from the Mount Angel Developmental Program. I barely make enough money to crack even because we get paid by the piece rate. I don't like this bill because that it could make things harder. It has been hard to make a living. Now, please do not make things tougher than it. Don't make things that are tougher.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you very much. Questions or comments?
I'd just like to thank them for coming up and telling us about your position and your feelings on this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Rick Newton, Mark Boffman, and Heather Miewald. Please proceed in whatever whatever order you choose.
I'll go ahead. My name is Heather Meewald. I'm a disability specialist at Portland Rehabilitation Center. I make all the determinations of whether people meet our criteria for severely disabled, and I wanted to explain a little bit about how I make those determinations and address any concerns that we're not employing people who are severely disabled. And I also wanted to, before I explain that, I wanted to point out the difference between substance abuse and substance dependence, which I think was an issue of people being qualified as substance abusers. I wanted to point out, I'm not a medical provider, but I know that the DSM-4 criteria for substance abuse and substance dependence are quite different, and substance dependence requires a physiological dependence on the substance, and at that point, it's not purely a voluntary thing. I wanted to say that under the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act, which sets out the definition of severely disabled, that we follow substance abuse would never be considered a severe disability. And in most cases of substance dependence, the substance dependence is actually a symptom of some other disability, an underlying mental health issue that's fueling the dependence. And I also like to point out that even though substance dependence would be considered a disability, I would never qualify anybody based solely on substance dependence. When I do qualify somebody who has a history of substance dependence, it's because there's an additional disability that I feel is severe, and I would put that person on a drug and alcohol contract that is conducted. It's a one-year contract that mandates random drug testing for a year, and that's conducted by an independent company. And then I just wanted to explain a little bit about the three-step process that we use to make determinations of severe disability. And if I go over my time, feel free to just cut me off. First, we determine whether there's a medically determinable impairment, and that requires documentation signed by a licensed provider. It doesn't include people like qualified mental health providers. It has to be somebody with a license that's regulated by a state. We can also accept state or local government verification of disabilities. And in many cases, I'd like to point out that even though that meets our minimum requirements in the JWAD Act, we request more because we're not sure that it meets our criteria. The second thing we look for are functional limitations in self-care, self-direction, work skills, and work tolerance, communication or mobility that are so severe that they would prevent that person from being able to maintain normal competitive employment over an extended period of time. Obviously, that entails looking at a person's work history and whether they've had a stable work history, whether they've been accommodated, and if they haven't had a stable work history, whether that there are direct correlations between their disability and the instability in the work history. My predecessor developed this three-step analysis because she wanted a consistent and duplicable way to make disability determinations because the law is fairly general. It doesn't provide specific guidelines. And the person who developed this, her name is Maggie Hansen. She's gone to work for the President's Committee for Purchase for people who are blind and severely disabled. And she's now teaching compliance to all of the organizations in the country who do JWAD contracts. And so it's a good system. It's the standard for the country. And I'd like to say that our determinations are probably at this point the strictest in our industry. And that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity for WVRC to add our voice to the many you've already heard opposing these bad bills. My name is Martin E. Boffman, and I've been the executive director at WVRC since 1992. WVRC has been serving people with disabilities in the Lebanon and surrounding area for nearly 50 years, making it one of the oldest workshops in Oregon. We help people with all types of disabilities, most all types, including developmental, physical, and mental disabilities, by providing jobs. Our clients include Oregon veterans who, because of their service to our country, are faced with lifelong physical, mental, or stress-related disabilities. The jobs we provide are located at our workshop and in our surrounding communities. Since 1989, we have been providing jobs under the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. We are very knowledgeable about how important this program is to help us meet our mission of meaningful employment for the disabled, both in terms of stability and self-worth. I want to take this opportunity to express, along with WVRC's business board of directors, and I want to emphasize that, our board is made up primarily of small business owners and a public employee, the strong concern they all have about these bills. We are very familiar with the attacks on this law from a few businesses and recently the School Custodians Union. While we recognize their right to express their concerns, we do not think that QRS present a real threat to either business or labor. Oregon's Department of Administrative Services estimated that over 99% of all public purchases are already made with private business. 99%. Also, the Products of the Disabled Law has no bearing on public employees' jobs. It does not encourage those jobs to be privatized. It simply gives QRS the opportunity to negotiate for the few contracts that are privatized after the decision to seek outside contractors has been made. Mr. Chairman, in my brief message to you, I can't stress that point enough. We know the unions have a problem with any jobs being privatized, but this is not related to the law. It is our organization's belief that one of the bad bills, HB 2842, placing four of nine members, two from business and two from unions, is extremely unfair, especially since this bad bill, if passed, would give the commission rule writing and appeal authority, and the remaining five position definitions are too vague. What about all the real stakeholders left out of the bill's language? The list of professionals unaccounted for in this bill include county mental health case managers, Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation, the State Developmental Disabilities Office, senior and people with physical disabilities, the Veterans Administration, and qualified rehab facilities like the organization I represent. The bill also ignores public purchasers and from state agencies as well as political subdivisions. I would suggest the group that I just mentioned has more at stake in respect to this issue than do the unions or private business. The makeup of the proposed commission is too biased. Nothing like this exists in any state in the country for these laws. If a commission were to exist at all, it should include representation from the stakeholders I've just mentioned and should be organized as an advisory commission to the Department of Administrative Services. DOS has implemented the program fairly for 30 years, fairly. And we would be happy for business and labor to be added to the present advisory council. As Representative Girard has stated, you don't need a bazooka to fix something that only requires a pea shooter to get the job done. On behalf of our 45 disabled workers employed by this law, please don't overreact and damage this great program because of the concerns of a few. I want to take this time in closing to share with you a typical worker employed by us as a result of this law. We'll call him John. John suffers from autism, a very debilitating illness. John came to WVRC in 1993 and with his parents' support asked our organization for a job. At that time, John lived at home and was receiving financial support from both federal and state government. We hired John to work at one of our custodial contracts that we had negotiated as a result of the products law. John's self-esteem, worth, and personal independence grew as a result of the support we gave him in connection with his job. How did this job change John's life? He no longer lives at home. He no longer is financially supported by the state and federal government. The wage and benefits he earned as our employee allowed him to first transition to an apartment and live on his own. A few years ago, he took that giant step when he went out and bought his own condo and now pays property tax, the same as most of us gathered here tonight. And as his boss, I have that conversation with him. Why doesn't his wages keep pace with tax bills? Just like some of those conversations we all have as we drink coffee in the morning. Make no mistake about it. John will suffer from autism for his life. Make no mistake about it. John will always need some support on the job site, including retraining and other habilitative support. With the law in place, as it is, free from political ambush, John will have a job with WVRC as long as he wants one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you, Representative Witt and the committee. My name's Rick Newton. I'm the Associate Director at Mount Angel Developmental Programs. So we're a residential and employment provider for people who experience developmental disabilities in Polk, Marion, and Clackamas counties. And I won't waste your time echoing what you've already heard from my colleagues. I want to speak as a brother. You heard my younger sister a moment ago. I've worked 30 years in the field, and I've come to understand that I have a lot more in common with those I serve than differences. The main difference I see is that they were dealt a lot harder hand than I was. Yet I see people doing their best every day, holding their heads up, taking pride in their work. RQRF is a place where people find meaning and dignity. The paychecks are small, but the fulfillment is huge. And I have a younger sister who experiences developmental disabilities. My younger sister was dealt that tougher hand. Through the years, I've seen her stereotyped and marginalized and ridiculed. I recall walking around the schoolyard, knees knocking, looking for the kids that had been teasing my sister, hoping that I wouldn't find them. But I had to stand up for my sister, and I'm here standing up for her tonight. I believe, to be candid with you, that I want to get the job done every day at work. And another bureaucracy rippling out things that are going to distract me from the work, the good work that I have in front of me, concerns me, and I oppose these bills for that reason. Many of the folks that we do work with do move on to competitive employment, but they do it because they've gotten skills that they've learned in our QRF. Oregonians with disabilities make contributions to Oregon every day, and they do so willingly with brave smiles on their faces. And these bills would potentially threaten these people, including my sister's sense of productivity, dignity, and self-respect. These bills are dangerous.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you all very, very much for your testimony. Folks, again, I really want to emphasize the fact that the witnesses need to be brief because we do not have enough time for everybody to testify if we continue at this pace. So I really encourage you to stick to 3 minutes. With that, it's very difficult to read the writing. It looks like Travis Paulson and Dave Schaefer and Pete Sensor. Just ask you to please be mindful of the time so that we can try and get everybody in. Good evening.
Hi. Good evening. I'd like to introduce Travis. Travis, I'm Dave Schaefer. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of DePaul Industries in Portland. Travis Pearson is a general manager of two of our divisions, and he's available for any questions should there be any.
Thank you.
DePaul Industries, which formerly was known as St. Vincent DePaul Rehabilitation Service, was founded in 1971. It started in response to a request from the state of Oregon as a small sheltered workshop to employ disabled adults who were being relocated from Salem, the Fairview facility, to group homes in the Portland area. This sheltered workshop is still at the core of our mission, and we currently employ 35 developmentally disabled adults through our supported employment division. Over time, it became evident that the problems of employing adults with disabilities was much broader, much bigger than the various sheltered workshops employing solely developmentally disabled adults could help. Thousands of Oregonians with disabilities presenting significant barriers to employment were unable to find work. They were falling through the cracks. Therefore, to try to make as big of a dent as possible to this large and growing problem, we structured our business model to employ as many disabled adults as possible, with both us and the employees requiring as few handouts as possible. We have utilized the existing law to provide meaningful employment to a significant number of disabled Oregonians, Oregonians that wanted to work but couldn't get a job because of their disability. Besides contractual opportunities we have earned as a result of this law, we employ many disabled adults in many private sector companies throughout Oregon and in our own packaging facility in Portland. We also provide computer skills training and employee employability assessments for hundreds of disabled Oregonians every year. We currently employ over 500 disabled adults every day. This law has been one of the major factors in helping us make a dent in this significant problem. And quite honestly, as a result of the work being performed by our employees, we are doing it with virtually no cost to the taxpayers. It is a very efficient model. So I question why it makes any sense to change the present efficient structure. The current system works. If it isn't broken, why fix it? And I'd like to add one more thing. I politically am very much in the middle. I don't sway one way or the other, but I probably lean a little bit toward being conservative. So for me to say leave it with the government, leave it with DAS, would maybe go against what I normally say, but the fact is it works. So don't try to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Debbie Clevenger, and I work with DePaul Industries. Mm-hmm. And my disability is I have adult ADHD and a memory loss. And I have worked with DePaul Industries for about a year and a half, in which they have placed me with several different jobs with the state. I have worked with the DMV. I've worked with the State Data Center and also with the Bridge Section. And sorry about that. And I have been laid off many jobs because of my disability. And a lot of times it wasn't just because that I couldn't do the job, because I could do the job. I had the skills to do it. But a lot of times when I would go to a job and I would be honest with the employer and tell them that I have a disability and I need just a little bit more time to learn something, because not everybody's the same. Everybody learns differently. And sometimes when they would find out this, they would fire me. Just for the simple fact that I had a disability, I didn't even get a chance to show them what I could do or what I couldn't do. And also on several jobs, I have been ridiculed, been put down. I have been threatened by other employees. I have gone to managers, the business owners, and tell them what was going on, and they would fire me. Just because they didn't want to deal with it. So for me, DePaul Industries has been really great because I've got to go to different jobs. I'm not ridiculed. I'm not put down. They have been really understanding when I've been going to a job. And the one thing is with the DePaul Industries is that they know that I'm disabled. And so that helps a lot. And when you have a disability and you can't help it, it's really hard, really, really hard, because it's not something that I went out and did. I was born like this. But And one thing is also, it's nice to go to a job that you know that you're safe. And very safe. Sorry, I've never done this before.
You're doing very well.
And also I want to say is that I have three children, and they are also disabled. In fact, I have a son-in-law who is also disabled, and he also works. He goes to DePaul Industries. He is doing their computer classes so he can keep employed. And I have a 15-year-old son who is autistic. And he's going to be looking for a job in the next 3 years. And he wants to work so bad. And he is highly, highly intelligent. But it's going to be a struggle for him. And so that's the nice thing about DePaul Industries and the other ones are that he'll have an opportunity to have a job also. So I guess what I'm asking is if you guys could just please, this funding for these programs they're so good for the people that are disabled, and it makes you feel that you can contribute even though you're disabled. And I can make a wage that's above minimum wage and feel that I'm important to the community, I'm important to myself, and I'm important to my family.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the committee?
I think she did an outstanding job.
Did do an outstanding job. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And taking your evening to come down and present it to us. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Jerry Eggers, Marianne Guest, and J.L. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marianne Guest representing the Oregon School Employees Association and a requester of the two bills before you. Would you like me to walk through the amendments, or you want me to ignore them at this point? What would you like, Mr. Chair?
If you can do it and do it in a fairly timely manner.
I could briefly just describe why they're before you.
Okay, that would be good.
The amendments before you were brought to you after a conversation with the Department of Administrative Services, who asked us to amend the bill to make it more administratively work with their system. And so the amendments before you would then leave most of the duties with the new commission, would change. I mean, the original bill.
Hold on just a second, Marianne, okay. Please. The committee members, those amendments are in the packet that Barry prepared for each of us. Dash two amendments?
Yes, they
okay,
are.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Our original bill had the new commission doing most of the new duties under the PDIL. We met with DAS, who said that a lot of those duties could stay with them, so we amended the bill with the dash one. Now we're at the dash two, which again moves most of the duties back to the new commission and has DAS advising the commission. We also we designate five people on the commission that would come from the disabled advocates, and then two from business and two from labor. So that's pretty well consistent. So those are the basic changes of the bill. We met with DAS at 5 o'clock. Nobody had seen the amendments yet, but they said they probably had some technical fixes that they would suggest to the amendments. So there's more to come. So,
and Marianne, the thought behind these amendments is
just for DAS, they said we want this program to work if we're going to pass these bills. And in order to work, mm-hmm. we feel it is more appropriate to have the commission mm-hmm. perform the policy, the administrative rules, basically everything, and then the DAF would continue to procure the contracts. They still would handle state procurement. We would not enter into that.
All right. Thank you very much.
And further explain, I've listened to the testimony, and I've been quite concerned by the testimony and what I've heard. I want to be clear that the unions are involved for one reason. When a school district, for example, contracts out, we currently, because our members are affected, are allowed to go to the school district and contract and negotiate to keep wages and benefits for the workers and to transfer their work to the contracted agency or the private contractor. So our workers don't lose wages. They don't lose benefits. We're allowed to do that. When it happens with under the PDIL and it goes to a QRF, we are not allowed to do that. And so workers' wages and benefits are lost. That is why we are here. It is not a contracting out issue. It's an employment issue for us. And I just want to clarify that. I also would say that I'm quite concerned with the reference that any of these bills would put anyone that has testified here today or the other day out of work. That is not true. And I'm concerned that that is what people have been told. These bills were designed to make sure that the severely disabled, without question, that they are served and have employment. This bill was additionally designed to make sure that employees, that the disabled individuals will also be mainstreamed into employment in the workforce. This program, these bills are designed to put the disabled to work. Right now, if you look at the numbers, and Representative Witt pointed out, the numbers for what the state is spending and for who they're employing are totally out of whack with other states. They're spending an awful lot of money and not putting very many people to work, and that's discouraging. Also, a lot of we've heard, and I'm assuming that many of you have heard, the problems that exist with the national program that serves the severely disabled. Incredible problems. And it's because of lack of oversight. It is because lack of definitions. It is because of the very issues that we come to you today to solve. Now, we can all have these programs blow up in our face, or we can start to pay attention to them and see if, in fact, we are serving the population adequately, if we're spending the dollars. This is a lot of public tax dollars at stake here. Could be $50 million. We keep hearing that, but it could be $100 million. I'm not sure. And I don't think anybody here is sure. And it's time to make sure of what this program is doing and to make sure it works and serves the right populations. So I implore you, to even though this is an emotional issue for so many people, our intent, and it will not change, is to make sure that these individuals have employment and are served well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson. I represent the NFIB. We have 12,000 independent companies in our organization. Just briefly on the Dash 2 amendments, two clarifications. We want to make sure that the committee understands that there are five. There's a majority of the commission is set aside for those who represent individuals with developmental or other disabilities. That is meant to cast a wide net so as to capture a broad representative group of those who advocate for the disabled, and our intent very much is to give them a majority stake and a majority position on the commission, because quite frankly we feel that they're more than adequate to they should deserve the right to chart their own course. The mission statements stay the same with regard to
furthering the policy of the state to encourage and assist individuals with disabilities who cannot participate fully with reasonable accommodation and competitive employment to find useful, productive, and gainful employment. That is the overarching philosophy of this committee, to help these folks find good work. And that is what we've commissioned this PDIL commission to do. I provided for you two examples of other states. It's been mentioned that nobody has charted this course, when in fact it doesn't take long to figure out that several states chart their own course, and some of whom use formal boards and commissions to do exactly what we're asking today. And I know this because one of my counterpart in Wisconsin is on the Wisconsin State Use Board. And I consider this, quite frankly, to be probably the best in the country. And I think it is something that Oregon can look at because ours is modeled after this, and say we want to emulate this because the product it produces serves the disabled better than any other that I know. And furthermore, the level of accountability here is unmatched. And I would invite you to take a look at this Wisconsin State Use Board annual report from 2005, but just note a couple key items. First of all, the commission very much does have rulemaking authority. They do have autonomy to coordinate and monitor the program, establish eligibility criteria for work centers, promulgate rules. You see here down the bullet points on page 5, review. And here's a key issue that gets to the heart of private sector concerns. Review each order and contract for the impact of the state use program on private sector employers to make sure that the state use program would not take away more than 15% of any private contractor's business. Now, when we talk about private employer concerns, the state of Wisconsin does this right, because they say, do you have, Mr. Private Businessman, if you offer goods and services that are suitable under this law, the chances are you stand to lose some business, but we will draw a bright line as to how much business you can lose under this program. The Wisconsin program does have business representation, 2 of the 8 positions. But I think what's most key, Mr. Chair, is when you look at what this agency is doing, what this commission is doing, and you look at the number of employed from 2001 to 2005, they're employing numbers that are comparable to Oregon, and you look on the last page here, with 20% of the money that Oregon is using. The numbers indicated in 2006, Oregon public sector expenditures, state of Oregon, was over $50 million. Here you see in Wisconsin it's less than 9.5, and they're producing comparable results. And the fact that they can even show you results at all in terms of employment, hours worked, wages in one concise sheet shows a level of accountability that I think is lacking here in Oregon today, and is something we should aspire to. So, well, I would invite you to look at the Wisconsin example for something along the lines of when you have leadership, when you have accountability, when you have fairness, you can make this work, and you can make it work better. And this is to me an example of maximizing resources for the benefit of the disabled. I included a Connecticut annual report too. Their advisory committee is more advisory as opposed to a commission, but there were a couple of things I wanted to draw your attention to here. One of which is they have this is a advisory council that's creative, that employs private sector involvement on this council as well. And they do creative things. They have a committee called the Business Partnership Committee to enhance employment outcomes for people with disabilities and try to get them integrated into the private competitive workforce. I mean, this is the type of creative thinking that this commission mm-hmm. could be a conduit for, and we are very excited about using this commission in such a way. The bottom line is, when you look here, the program in Connecticut serves just as many people as it does in Oregon, plus it helped over 1,250 people gain competitive employment in the private marketplace. It has employment strategies to offer stronger connections with employers, and they do all of this for $9 million, 20% of the amount that was spent in Oregon in 2006. So it's our way of saying there are models out here that other states employ that are creative, that provide leadership, that provide accountability, and they maximize resources to maximize employment opportunities for the disabled. And I just think that these are very instructive, and these are exactly the heart of the issue when we talk about this commission. The last point I'll draw on, Mr. Chair and members, is my personal experience with boards and commissions in this state. I have a feeling that part of the trepidation surrounding this bill is that there's just not a lot of knowledge about the Senate confirmation process, what it is to put together a board or a commission. And I can tell you the vetting process that goes through the Senate, through a governor appointment and a Senate confirmation, is one where candidates are vetted very carefully. Their opponents on this issue have concerns about the people that we want to represent, they are free to let us know, and we are very willing to work with them to accommodate a 9-member commission that will work together in a very efficient manner to produce a product that meets the specifications of what this commission is supposed to do. In other words, to accomplish the mission statement. And that is something that is not uncommon. Mr. Chair, you and I served on the MLAC committee together, divergent viewpoints, business and labor, very divergent. Sometimes we flat out did not get along, but the bottom line is it was 10 people from opposite views who came together to produce a darn good product in our workers' compensation system. And the fact is, we all knew how to work together, and we all had the same goals in mind, which was a system that served the interest of businesses and labor, because that's who the system was made for. This is exactly the type of vetting process and the type of collaboration that goes into a governor appointment and a Senate confirmation. And I can assure you and the committee that I have been here in good faith to talk about these bills from the beginning, and I will be here to continue to talk in good faith about putting together a commission that allows the majority stakeholders to be advocates of the disabled, because they deserve to chart their own course. But the folks that we put to the table and the folks that they bring to the table will work collaboratively, because that's what goes into this process of appointing a board or a commission. So with that, I'll wrap up. I think that the opportunities here are exciting with what you can do with this board, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Egger, and I would like to thank the committee for last weekend, for this evening, and letting all the voices be heard. I did want to make one clarification. I'm very interested in looking at DASA's number regarding the people that are served under that program, and I think if you'll note in last week's testimony, it's going to be an interesting proposition to kind of clarify the time periods that DAS based that data on, and I think once we get specific points in time, and we can hopefully arrive at a good number. Tonight, I wanted to focus on essentially the suitability determination process that really has really come in place only formally since 2003. From 1977 up until 2003, there was no formal suitability process, which means no business, no labor, no adversely or interested party had a chance to even know about what was going on with this program. And unfortunately, I didn't find that out until about 5 or 6 years into the program, that there actually was an advisory council. And then I find out that it's not subject to public meetings laws. And really, no voice could be heard, whether or not we wanted to help the program or protect our businesses, which was my case. But since that time, companies have gone out of business down in Eugene, United Security, companies have lost business. And part of that is simply because people aren't aware of who the law is intended to serve. And as a matter of fact, as far as I'm aware, based on my study and on DAS information, DAS has only completed 50% of the suitability determinations and price setting requirements that the legislature delegated to DAS in 1977 for the first 30 years of the program. I'm astonished at that. Essentially, they had no formal process, and then in 2003, they grandfathered all the products and services that were in existence at that time, and they're still not done. And to this date, the only way that a affected party or interested party becomes notified is that they have to check the DAS website every single day. And even then, if you protest or submit any kind of a letter, DAS further screens you out, and for example, a union, a labor union that wants to protect its workers, has no standing in DAS's eyes. So that's an interesting situation. Or in my case, where I happen to have a QRF competitor that has many divisions, even though the 75% is based organizational wide, I can't even give any input, and DAS doesn't even respond to it. And you know, I have a lot of documentation, but I'm just going to bring up one other example. That in the Hillsborough School District is an example where DAS, PHC, and the Hillsborough School District discussed really the fact that PHC could take over that district janitorial services without a single disabled individual because of the numbers of individuals that PHC employs. I was shocked at that. In other words, there is no minimum per contract of disabled people, and I think that's wrong. And I think that's part of what the commission could look at, and it's also related to clarifying who's really to be served. And I know you've heard a lot of testimony, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair Riley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Hillsborough School District,
mm-hmm.
Did PHC get that contract?
I don't believe so, but they reserve the right to obtain it, and I think there were discussions and emails that were going back and forth, and I do have some documentation I could share with you or give to you regarding that. There's also other agreements related to that in terms of trying to maintain the preference under the PDIL program even if they were displaced from a contract, and that's a different but related issue.
I would like that documentation.
Representative Dahl.
No procedural for you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Jerry, you referenced that you had a number of cases. In the last hearing that we had, there were a number of references to the fact that there was not a substantive number of cases that were that were described here in the hearing room to suggest or warrant a change to the existing structure or the existing statute. You just mentioned that you had a number of references. Do you have, and I'd also underscore the fact that I think there's a general feeling that a lot of the concern had been directed towards old cases that happened back in the 1990s and before. Is there anything current?
Well, I'd say the Hillsborough School District. I'd say, well, in 2004, similar situations, agreements, side agreements that reference the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act that don't really address the PDIL, but in other words, they're using different laws to, DAS is using different laws to administer the PDIL program. In terms of actual harm to small business, I've lost contracts, and once a contract is put into place, there's a lot of companies out there that actually don't even know why they're losing the contract. That would be the case like with Mick Kochler of Kochler Landscape in the Lebanon School District, for example, lost a contract, or Chorak Mowing, or several, I guess, 2, 3, 4 years ago, 2002-03, United Security had no idea why they lost the Eugene Airport Unarmed Security Guard contract. And they went out of business, so they had no funds, resources to even look into it. Kim Morris from Carpet Cleaning up in the Portland area, they lost thousands of dollars on contracts.
How recent are these examples?
Probably 2-3 years, within the last 2 to 3 years old.
Okay.
And then, you know, in terms of the national issue, you've really got the federal program that's being looked at, and the General Accounting Office just completed in January of this year its review of the federal program, and they really pointed out numerous conflicts of interest and how the program has skyrocketed, and essentially looking at compliance issues. The bottom line on that was they really didn't have any standards of measurement or haven't really set any performance goals. And that's pretty much what we've been talking about, back to these numbers of how many individuals this program employs and what JL has talked about in Wisconsin and other state programs, trying to compare apples to apples instead of, you know, saying $50 million isn't a lot of money to a small business like me. That's a ton of money. That's a lot of money.
Okay. Thank you. We've had several references to the fact that the existing law works and that, in essence, it's not broken, so why try and fix it? Could you explain, please, what your interest is in attempting to fix this and why you think it needs to be fixed?
Thank you, Chair Witt. Again, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB. What started out for us on this issue as it pertained to Jerry's situation was, how could it be in Oregon with a program that dedicates this many million dollars on set-aside contracts and would exclude someone like Jerry from having a say in his own contract that gets taken from him? How do you have a situation where there's no notice, there's no public meetings, there's no open records, there's no ability for a private business owner to call into question the validity of this issue or bring in his perspective, that is, someone like Jerry, who he might not say it, but, you know, he was a disabled employer of the year in the year 2004 for one QRF. And why is it a good policy for him to lose business when he hires disabled folks? And should that policy consideration not be integrated in this whole decision-making process of whether he loses contracts? So, and then I got issues from other small business owners, whether it's Bob Dean, and you heard today, or Kim Morris, people who'd lost contracts and had no connection with this law, other than the fact they knew it was just used against them, used to take a contract. So the issue really became one of fairness, and for me it was one of openness and transparency, because I couldn't conceive of a situation in Oregon today where you had millions of dollars in set-aside contracts and adversely impacted parties who just quite honestly weren't taken seriously and weren't even considered in the process. And so that sparked my personal interest in this issue. And then it led to further investigation, and you talk about issues of when did the definition change in Oregon from severely due to just not severely disabled. When did the 75% of disabled labor per contract all of a sudden morph into 75% agency-wide? When did there become a point in time when there was not a grace period for a QRF to take a contract even though they didn't have the labor, and then all of a sudden there's a grace period of a year or more that would allow them to ramp up and take contracts without disabled? Did the legislature have any bearing on this policy? No. And did anybody, any elected official? No. And so when we talk about this issue of concern, stuff like this impacts Jerry. It impacts small business owners across the state. And so we just wanted to elevate this commission. And the commission really was born out of no other premise than there should be an open, transparent process to accommodate all interested parties, even adversely impacted parties, in this under the PDIL statute. So that's what gave rise to our interest, and that's why you have the bill in front of you today.
JL, could you expand a little bit, because that was another question I wanted to ask, and you just mentioned you want a transparent process. We've had testimony this evening that the existing process or system, statutes, is in fact transparent. Comments on that?
Thank you, Chair Witt and members. I don't know how you would consider that transparent. What you have today is an advisory council that advises the chief procurement officer, and that certainly isn't subject to any public meeting or public records. And you're talking about $50 million in set-aside contracts. And I quite frankly, I guess what I would deem as the measure of transparency is if somebody who's going to be adversely impacted has any knowledge whatsoever that this is happening to them, and do they have any ability to get their point of view across? And the answer is no. And as long as you answer no to that question, then I don't believe you could seriously say that there's transparency. You also have questions about numbers employed. We heard there was two sets of numbers employed. Just how much money is at stake, whether public contracts, private contracts, in-kind contributions. None of this information is exactly forthcoming. You see it in Wisconsin. That's why I'm so impressed with this Wisconsin model, because that information is right out there for you to see. And I believe you deserve that. And I deserve that as a taxpayer and as a representative of small business. And so I'd say as long as we are dealing with this issue in Oregon, that there, in fact, is not adequate transparency.
We have had a lot of witnesses come before this committee and express their concern about their continued employment. I asked you in the last committee hearing if you thought there was any possibility at all, given these two bills, that anyone who is seriously disabled could in any way feel threatened with a loss of employment. At that time, you told me you had absolutely no doubt I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I believe your testimony was that, to the contrary, the intention was, at least under the previous bill, and I don't know, I haven't even looked at the amendments, that employment would be expanded. Would you please characterize?
Thank you, Chair Witt and members. I don't believe that employment will go anywhere else but up. And the reason being is you see programs in other states with leadership, with creativity, with accountability, and they're making more with less than we are in Oregon today. I would couple that with the fact that we have clearly made an effort to ensure that representatives of the disabled are the people who drive this process and drive this board, because quite frankly, I believe that in a commission setting, with everybody involved, that they will demand more from this program than it currently delivers. And so I don't have any problem saying, not only do I not believe that employment will go down, I believe wholeheartedly that employment will go up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Marianne Gelst, and I, there is absolutely no question in my mind that those with significant disabilities will be better served by these bills. I also would add, if you remember, in our amendments, we had at Representative Sarah Gelser's suggestion added that the commission would also work to find employment opportunities in the workforce rather than through QRFs for all disabled people. And I think, part of the reason we're here, part of the reason this program has gotten, as I have characterized, out of control, is the fact that the PDIL program is the only guaranteed employment opportunity for disabled. It's the only one in Oregon. And what is happening is the folks that are disabled not as severely are looking for employment opportunities. Because of Representative Gelser's amendment, we will be able to actually have a public commission with interested parties look at this issue to find ways to expand employment opportunities for disabled people in mainstream workforce. I think that's extremely important. Thank you.
Regarding the commission, we had testimony this evening that the commission that is proposed under 2842 would be more expensive than the current advisory group.
your comments.
Thank you, Chair Witten, members of the committee. There is no doubt this bill will invoke a fiscal impact statement. Currently, DAS spends just about $700,000 to administer the program. The interesting thing is DAS only allocates 1.5 FTE to administer essentially a $50 million program. And what you've seen as a result of that lack of allocation of funding and staff is a backlog of 50% of the suitability determinations that Jerry alluded to earlier. I don't see under any stretch of the imagination how that could be considered efficient or a well-run program when you have a backlog of 50% because there was basically the decision to grandfather in 30 years worth of suitability determinations because there was no formal process, and in 2003 decided that they're actually going to go through a formal process to do all that. I would consider that decidedly inefficient. So will this bill invoke a fiscal that's more than what DAS spends today? Yes, it's true. The question that has to be asked is how much money should DAS be spending to administer this program today in an efficient fashion? Because I think you can make a very strong case that they're not spending nearly enough on this program today to do it in an efficient way.
We had several witnesses testify this evening that a 5-4 commission is unfair and biased.
Thank you. I'm happy to let you answer that, Marianne. But I would just say I don't envision that these are going to be 5-4 issues. There's this preconceived notion that everything that comes down the pike is going to be 5-4 because all businesses oppose the program, all labor opposes the program, and necessarily that all advocates of the disabled are on the opposite side. I don't view that this is going to be a case at all, and honestly, I attribute it probably to my friends on the other side who probably just don't have a familiarity with the commission process and kind of the collegiality and the work that goes in under accomplishing a mission statement. So I look at the private sector viewpoint as this. Do we guarantee openness? Absolutely. Does private sector creativity and ingenuity come into place in terms of how do you administer the program and get more bang for the buck? Absolutely. How do employers are best equipped to advise this council as a meaningful member to getting disabled folks into the competitive workplace? And that's why I believe ultimately having a private sector voice is so critical on this committee. And so I stand by that, but ultimately the majority of the council consists of folks who are advocates of the disabled, because I will not waver in this belief. They deserve the right to chart their own course, and we want to give them every ability to do so.
And then we had at least one reference. I'm not sure. There may have been others this evening, but and also several in our first hearing, something to the akin that the commission would create a bureaucracy that would get in the way of the work that the QRFs are attempting to conduct.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members. The problem with the program today is that DAS doesn't allocate near the time and resources into this program that it deserves. What I endeavored to give you today was examples of states with commissions in place that show real results. This is not an uncommon strategy that's employed in other states, because it is employed in other states. And I give you this Wisconsin example because you've got a commission there that is empowered with policy setting, rulemaking, and doggone it, they are delivering results. It's right here for everybody to see. They've got numbers. They've got growth, not just in terms of the amount of revenue, but then in terms of employment as well. And I don't see that somehow that Wisconsin is more capable of administering this than here in Oregon. I think that we're just as capable of making it successful.
And then I think a last and somewhat technical question. Jerry, you made reference in your testimony that there are no minimum numbers of disabled under the contracts. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, I have a document that shows that DAS doesn't care how many individuals work on each contract. At least that's my interpretation of it. I'll let you, Chair Witt, and members of the committee be the judge for themselves. But as far as I'm aware, there is no minimum. They use the terms appreciable. They use the term in the suitability determination, those that are trying to get a product or service deemed suitable may say how many people they will use, but the costs aren't based on any specific number, and there's no minimum requirement as far as I'm aware.
Expanding on that, and you actually triggered something here, I'm left to presume that at least mathematically there could be contracts where there are no disabled, given the 75% rule?
Under the current administration, under the current rules that DAS promulgated in 2003, taking an organizational-wide view, you can have, and I believe that's the case in my research, you can have work hours of direct labor from one division, in essence, offsetting labor in another. And when you have the types of jobs that QRS have taken on right now, such as light maintenance and other, in my opinion, highly skilled positions that would be deemed competitive, that's a real concern, and I believe that's the case in some situations. And like I said, I'll share with you some documentation that's 2004, 2005. And that's a policy decision I can't answer, but from what I've seen, there's no safeguards against that occurring.
Would you share that with us when you...
I will, definitely.
Thank you very much. Representative Dahl.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I have quite a list of concerns. Transparency, the razor-sharp edge of competitiveness. Is there any way that the present structure... and appeals process. I think Chair Witt covered them quite nicely. Is there any way that, in your mind, that the present structure could be modified? Could amendments be made that would modify the present structure to shape it and put it in a position to do the things that you think have to be done?
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlman, I think the current structure is broken. I think DAS has abandoned its duty under this program by virtue of essentially not even fulfilling its statutory obligation to do a suitability determination in the first 25 years of the program. They've only completed 50% of those, and at every step of the way has essentially protected itself against any, I'm going to say, sunshine. Not only to, in many ways, to the disabled community, but especially to business and other adversely impacted or interested parties. And, for example, in 2001, I participated in a DAS-sponsored work group, which specifically looked at, for several days, at what the definition of a disabled individual meant in the statute. And at the end of 2.5 days, I was asked by the now deputy director for me to contribute funds in order to continue that process. I thought I was, you know, doing my duty and with the knowledge that I had to try and assist DAS to do good work. But when we got close to what that definition meant, they asked for money from private sector business to do their job. And so that's been indicative of my experience with DAS, and that's also true with DAS creating walls in terms of the suitability determinations. For example, in the case of OSEA or in other individuals that have submitted protests to suitability determinations, they simply say you don't have standing because that's our position.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlman, if I can answer your question too, I when the discussion was occurring around this issue, one of the answers was that the legislature should take a look at the policy that they set 30 years ago and determine, you know, what needed to happen. One of those bills was 2732, which actually defined disabled for the purposes of the Products and Disabled Individual Law. That is one thing you can do as policymakers, is better define the law, which has not had any policy discussion for 30 years. And it has changed dramatically in 30 years by just lack of definition. So it just keeps expanding. You could just add the term, the same term that every one of the witnesses used, severely, to the definition of disabled, and that would help tremendously. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, has the Department of Administrative Services had any opportunity to present statistics, figures? I'd like to ask them for some information.
All right, Representative Dahlem, we will pose that question. Ellen, if you'd make sure that we make that request of DAS.
Something similar to the Wisconsin page.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing anything more. I think you wore us out. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And committee members, with that, is there anything more that you would like to discuss this evening?
Is this
no, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this a double feature?
committee members, with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2732 and 2842.
Can I ask you, Mr. Chair, procedurally, we have to, are we going to move this bill? And if we are,
well, it would be my intention, Representative Dahlem, to do that. And when necessarily means in the very foreseeable future. We're running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suspect that it would probably be, it will certainly be before the end of the month. How soon, I'm not sure. That's something that I'm going to have to, I'm going to need some time to sit down with Ellen and see how the calendar shapes up. And we're going to need to take a look at these amendments as well. I haven't even seen them before tonight, so.
And Mr. We have put together a work group.
Yes.
Can we discuss this offline, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely. Ellen, if you'd please give us a brief preview of tomorrow morning's agenda.
Thank you, Chair, Whip, members of the committee. It's my unfortunate duty to inform you that at 8 a.m. tomorrow, bright and early, you all will be hearing House Bill 2962, which concerns fuel breaks for fire enforcement purposes, House Bill 3223, which is a work session, along with 3224, and that's the Olympic track and field bills. We'll be having a work session on House Bill 2206, the skill up bill, and in your packets that Barry put together, there's a chart of all six of the amendments. And then finally, you'll be having a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2264, which is about the contracting code. And I would just point out that tomorrow at 8:30, you all have a floor session. It's my understanding that that floor session should last maybe about half an hour. So the intent is to be in committee for half an hour, recess, and then unfortunately come back.
Thank you very much. And with that, we stand adjourned until 8 a.m. in the morning. See you all then. Thank you, witnesses, very much.